Professor Jolovitz, thank you very much for agreeing to be interviewed for the Eminent Scholars Archive. Over the past few years, I've been talking to eminent academics associated with the faculty here at Cambridge, and I hope to use this opportunity to recall reminiscences of your life as well as memories of your colleagues and friends. In this way, we'll be able to create yet another valuable contribution to an archive of the faculty's history stretching back to just before the Second World War. You've had a very illustrious career. Listeners will also be aware that your father, Professor Herbert Jolovitz, was a famous Roman lawyer, so perhaps we can spend some time in this first interview recording your anecdotes of him, because he too has associations with the faculty. Your father was born in London in 1890. Can you tell me something about his family background?
Well, yes, his family, his parents, well, he's my grandfather, came here. I can refresh my memory much better if I take that document.
Sure.
This is a kind of a family tree of the Orwich clan. It's very out of date, but it goes back on. This was prepared by an American member of the family. It goes back, as you no doubt know, Jews didn't have surnames until the 1800s or so. This goes back to what, the 1800s. My father comes here. You know, it's one of the little things with numbers and so on.
Right. Goodness, so this goes back to 1871.
The clan. Yes. And they were divided up in this complicated way, but I can get it back more easily.
Interesting. You know. And they were from Hungary.
No, Poland. There was no such place as Poland in those days, but
That's right.
What became Poland?
Right. So, your grandfather, your father came, was born in this
in
country.
London. Oh yes.
And presumably his father came from Poland.
Yes. But a place called it's all here anyway. He was born here. Father had come out, that's my grandfather, had come over from what is now Poland as a teenager, about 1865.
And that was Hermann.
Yes. Hermann Jolovitz.
Right. Do you know why he came to this country?
Well, I think probably because of fears of pogrom and so on.
Right.
Because the Poles were never very very pro-Semitic.
And it was overrun from time to time.
Well, that was nasty. Did you ever see Fiddler on the Roof?
In my youth,
yes. Well, that's not far from the truth. People get. I don't think he was actually pushed out. The family were booksellers, so the origin. But you want a little anecdote? I didn't know this even. I looked at this last night again. That he apparently used to say that Justinian was the founder of our family.
How interesting.
Because my sister wrote this, how true it is, I don't know. When he got with a full-time appointment at Oxford and London, with a full-time appointment at Roman Law at UCL, he thought he had enough income and proposed to my mother. That was why he used to say Sir Justinian was the founder of the family.
How interesting. That's delightful. Mm. Well, it would be lovely if I could make a photocopy of that, and then we can incorporate that into the...
Well, you know, it's a lot of text, quite a lot of text.
Lovely. But, That would be very useful.
Anyway, you could take what you wanted from that.
Thank you. So your grandfather settled in London.
Well, he went and came via Lyon, actually. He was a silk merchant. And he apparently went first to Lyon, which was a focus of the silk industry at that time.
Lucky Mr. Dingle's here, because I reckon these books in Japanese can go straight to the squire. That's your parcel, thank goodness. Kevin must have come in. I didn't hear him come. Here you are.
What is it?
They're books from Japan. You couldn't be very kind.
Not Japan.
And bring the coffee in for me, could you? Because of my hands.
With pleasure. You were speaking about your grandfather and his...
Yes, he went first to Lyon and then came to London and fetched his wife-to-be, as it were, from Poland, got her over here. And they were all married here. All their children were born here.
Right.
My father being the youngest one of three.
Right. And your father went to St. Paul's
School.
Where he excelled.
Well, he got prizes in the classics.
Yes. What led him to law?
Well, he came up, he read the classics here and then switched to law as something he thought he might practice at one time. But he got interested in the Roman law, classical side and things. And then he came up, I think, in 1908. And for what it's worth, they used to, as you probably know, they used to divide the first classes. And he got what was known as a 1-1. And then he went over to Germany in 1914, 1934, he moved to Heidelberg and Freiburg, which were great centres of Roman law. And his German was extremely good, of course, and he went to lecture there. But people apparently were some surprise to see one of the lecture audience writing notes in English from the German lecturer. And in the summer of 1914, he went on a walking holiday with a friend in the Black Forest. And of course, no communications in those days, and they never saw the newspaper. They emerged into a little town somewhere on, I think, 1st of August, which has a certain importance, and discovered what was going on. And he got out with about 3 days to spare. 4th of August the war started. And he went into the army, to begin with the infantry, the Inns of Court Regiment, so-called, which it is. And he was apparently an ordinary subaltern, the infantry subaltern. And he was at one point sent to Gallipoli. He once introduced me to a gentleman called Mr. Price, and said to me, which was an odd remark, I thought, for a father to make to his son, "You owe your life to Mr. Price." What had happened, apparently, was he was on Gallipoli, and Mr. Price was an intelligence officer in Cairo, and went down briefly with a totally unimportant disease. She disabled him for a bit, with an adult male, as you know, the adult male German measles doesn't matter. And he got German measles and was part of that for a bit. And they sent word to my father's unit in Gallipoli to send a subaltern who spoke fluent German immediately back to Cairo, which my father was pulled out. About a week later, his unit was virtually totally destroyed.
Good heavens.
So he had a lucky stroke there, and then he was in the defenders for the rest of the war. In Cairo and later in France again. He'd been in France. And so he'd had the best 4 years plus as a soldier in the First World War. And then went into the academic career. What did you want to take that bow?
And he, after the war, he completed his law tripos before the war broke out. Yes, and then he volunteered. As you've told us, and he went into the Inns of Court, to the Bedfordshire Regiment.
That's right, yeah.
And he was also one of the select band of people who were involved in military operations in the Second World War.
And yes, because he went back again into the army in the Second World War. Not operations in the normal sense of going out trying to shoot people and being shot at. He was an intelligence officer.
So you don't have any idea of what he was doing?
Well,
he
was always very careful about it. It was quite a lot, mainly what to do with the interpretation of enemy wireless. He was not at Bletchley, but he did have quite a lot to do with the Enigma business. And I can't tell you much more about it than that, really, except that he went into, latterly, he became an instructor where there was a school for the intelligence in North London. And he did so after the war when he went back to teaching Roman law and jurisprudence. But he found it very difficult not to begin the first lecture by saying, now you must remember that it is the utmost importance that you do not mention a word about these lectures once you left this room. But then he went back into teaching. I've always thought it says something about the century. My father was a scholar, a peaceable man. Spent 8 years, effectively, of a relatively short life, because he was only 64 when he died, as a soldier.
As a soldier, yes. I noticed that he was called to the bar. Did he practice as a lawyer before going into academic life?
Very, very briefly. He did a pupillage, but he didn't really practice. No, he was, I think, it appeared in one or two cases, perhaps. Nothing much.
He became a lecturer in 1924 at UCL in Roman law and jurisprudence.
Mm, yeah, he'd done a good deal of research.
And then he was dean of law at UCL. Did he ever speak to you, Professor Jonowitz, of his experiences at
Not
UCL?
Not that there's a gap in that, if I may say so. He also had, for quite a long time, dates I'm not quite sure about, also readership in Roman law in Oxford. And for quite a long time, he travelled back and forth to Oxford to teach as a member of All Souls. And he was teaching in both London and in Oxford
right. For
a number of years. Certainly, I think when when I was born, he was doing that sort of thing. He lived in London, the family lived in London,
right.
But he went back and forth to Oxford.
And it was in this
once a week.
During this period that you were born, in 1926.
That's right, yes.
Yes.
Actually, at that time, dates are a bit dicey. He wasn't actually very busy being a professor. He was being a special constable because it was in the general strike. But I think I was born just after the general strike, and was quite sure.
Before his premature demise, he was the Regius Professor of Civil Law at Oxford for 6 years, from 1948 to 1954. And by the time he was in the post, Professor Jonowitz, you were 22 years old. Do you have any anecdotes of this period or reminiscences?
Well, when he went to... well, reminiscence, I suppose. I was... well, that's, I came up to Cambridge when I was 22, 48. And my father, but, I decided that I did, having been in the army myself, I had a 2-year degree and decided that I wanted to do a bit more without doing any more exams. I didn't want to do the LLB. And so under Jack Hampson, I wrote a dissertation for the Trinity College Prize Fellowship, which, to my immense surprise, I got. But I was still headed for the bar, and I went on and did my pupillage and so on. And I think my father was mightily surprised, because he was known to say once, "I wish that boy would do something with enthusiasm, even if it was only football." I was a pretty slack schoolboy, I think.
Professor Lipstein remembers going to your father's house for his examination in 1936. Yeah. You probably wouldn't have...
No, I do remember that very well, particularly because this is more a reminiscence, it's not about my father, more a reminiscence of Professor Lipstein. He was the first person who acted as a supervisor for me in international law, and I went along for the first supervision. Two or three other people, and I can't remember. And he said to me, "Oh, Tony, last time I saw you, you were in your pajamas, leaning over the banisters." And I never would have forgiven him that, because all the others were looking goggle-eyed. One is just a freak. That was the first time I met him, but that's quite what he was doing. He did his Viva in my parents' house, right. And then they had a dinner party.
Oh, how lovely.
But there was a strong connection, perhaps this is something with the German side of things, and Martin Wolf is an important figure in this way. He was, as I say, with my uncle by marriage. And of course, Lipstein was a pupil of Martin Wolf.
That's right, yes.
And even now, to a small extent, but it's dying, is I'm abroad somewhere where the Germans are about, and if I let it drop that I'm a nephew of Martin Wolf, they go, "Oh!" He was a really, really important man.
Yes.
And Lipstein, I felt that very much, and that was... was Mann, Francis Mann, was also a pupil of mine.
Right. Very interesting. We've mentioned before that Professor Stein recalls meeting you at your house, your home in Oxford. He mentioned that your father was very kind to him. Roman lawyers were thin on the ground, and they tended to sort of...
Yes.
Look after each other, and your father invited him to lunch. But you perhaps don't recall that, Professor Jonowitz.
I don't. That's the occasion when I was underneath the car.
When you were under the car, that was Professor Stein's first sighting of you. Your father's famous book, The Historical Introduction to the Study of Roman Law, which first appeared in 1932, was when you were 6 years old, the first edition came out. And then, of course, in 20 years later, the second edition came out. Did you help your father at all with this? In fact,
I'm not a Roman lawyer at all.
Right. The subsequent edition in 1972 with Barry Nicholas is still on the reading this, because the other day somebody was looking for it, one of the first
years. It's just been reprinted.
Right. Do you think, Professor Jonovich, that your father considered this to be his most important work?
I should suppose. Well, important is the biggest one. But I think, unfortunately, there was this posthumous publication of a part-finished thing with the Roman Foundations of Modern Law.
Right. I've seen that.
I had something to do with that.
Right.
And my mother really did a great deal with that. And then I did publish what turned into a book for him, his Roman, his jurisprudence lectures.
I've noticed that, and I'm having a look at that, actually. Very interesting. Yes. Professor Jonovich, that brings us then to your own childhood, your early career. Your boyhood was spent in pre-war London while your father was at UCL. Mm-hmm. Do you have any recollections of London at this time? Interestingly, Sir Ellie also grew up in London.
Yes, well, we knew each other. Ellie is the only extant human being whom I've known longer than anybody else, including my own sister.
Okay. How come? Because he's older.
He's younger than me.
But he's older than your sister.
Yes. It doesn't mean that I knew him almost from his birth.
Really?
Our fathers, of course, Jewish other.
Yes.
And I have known Ellie since he was born, because I'm that much older than he is. We've known each other forever.
Very interesting. Yes.
But he was shot off to America when the war started. I might have wasn't if I stayed here.
You were at the...
At the hall that they started, my school, prep school.
In London, yes. Any recollections of...
Well, I was still there in September of 39, and the school was evacuated to a sort of great manor place in Buckinghamshire. I can remember quite a bit about that extraordinary house, beautiful house. And a hopeless sort of school. It had a main staircase made of marble, which we were not allowed to use. Florence Nightingale, it was a Verney, there's a Verney family of the middle aristocracy, I think, who let it to the headmaster of this school, who I think probably never believed that he would have to evacuate, but that he needed something to show the parents that he got a lease on this house should the war break out. And he was only there for a term, took the school back to London just in time for the Blitz. By which time I left him after one term only, before I went on to London.
Where you were, to some extent, you were away from any of the...
Well, that was a boarding school.
And you were there for your entire, all your school days were spent at Arundel.
Yes, well, once I got to the age of 13, or it was 44, I went there. No, it can't be. 40.
So you were sheltered.
1940.
Sheltered to a great extent from the sort of war while you were... Was there anybody, Professor Jonovich, at the school who particularly influenced you? Teachers, perhaps, that you remember?
Yes, I suppose my housemaster, was a man called William Walker, classics master. And I did the classics there very poorly. And he was quite a character. A very keen on the school. And that was, I think, it was a good school. My son went there and he didn't, but...
So it was a happy time?
Well, reasonably so, yes. They're always worried.
Yes. You completed your schooling before the war ended, and you went into the forces in 1944, staying there for 4 years.
That's about right, yes. I went on one of these army short courses. The school, of course, had this training corps and I went to what thing was called a WASB, War Office Selection Board. And I was selected to go on one of these very curious courses, looking back, by the Army for 6 months to a university short course. And I went to Oxford, I was sent to Oxford, and I'm still an undergraduate member of Oxford University. I didn't get all the stuff, I get magazines. I was a member of Brasenose. I was asked for some sticks, that I know my sister says I was in Christchurch. That's wrong. I was physically in Christchurch. They combined, Brasenose was taken over by the Army. And Brasenose undergraduates were put into Christchurch. So I lived in Christchurch, but I was a Brasenose member. And still am.
Interesting. Did you have any memories of your time in service, especially towards the end of the war?
Well, I did this short course, and then I went in the regular way. And I served in Egypt, in the canals, mainly the canals. I had, I think, 6 months in Cairo. It was a surreal existence, in a way, because the war had ended. And when I was out there in the canal zone, in Cairo, my father had been demobilized, being very senior in age, was in the first group to be demobilized after the war. And they came out, as it were, to see me. We had a holiday in Egypt. They came out. We went on an hour cruise from Cairo up to Luxor.
That sounds delightful.
It was great, very fun. It was very weird. It's the only time I've been on a ship that didn't have a captain, it had a manager. And it was weird in a way, because it kept running aground. You know, the Nile, the sand shifts in the Nile. A great gentleman, and it would go quietly up and back and stop. The water in your glass hardly moved. Benjamin would get out the pole and push it off again. That was very nice. And I remember my father, who'd been in Egypt, and I said, found that they stayed in Shepherd's, their famous hotel, and he was very pleased because he could still find the bar. And I was there, I was in Egypt for a better part of 2 years, I think, more than 2 years, in charge of a little transport organisation, which employed all Egyptian drivers. And that was very troublesome because they all stole everything. You would lay hands on anything movable was stolen. And we had these drivers and we couldn't leave them with anything movable on their vehicles. No spare wheel. So if they ever had a flat, we had to send somebody out to rescue them. And that was quite tricky in some ways. And I was there for, I spent my routine, but most of that time I was on my own, not entirely alone, I mean with other English soldiers, but I was in sole command of that thing, quite small.
Well, you were quite young then?
Yes.
You were only about 21 or 22?
That's right, yes, I had my 21st birthday out there.
Right. Gosh. So you left the forces in 1948 and you arrived at Cambridge as an undergraduate to actually your father's old college, Trinity.
Yes.
And you would have been one of
the... I can break in the middle of it, which may be of interest, that during the period after I'd been demobilised and coming up here, having talked about that, I knew I wasn't going to be a serious rebel. And he agreed that I could get rid of the Roman law in bar exam before I ever came up.
Right.
So I went to his lecture at the University College.
Oh, interesting.
And had what you might call supervisions at home with my father and took the Roman law bar examination before I came up.
Did you enjoy his lectures?
It was a very weird experience. Enjoy them. I just think it would be quite embarrassing because some people in the audience knew who I was and others not. And you get this sort of episode happen and somebody would say in the middle of the
Very
But I survived it and I didn't spend any time there. I went to the college for these lectures and nothing else. I came away. I used the library, I worked there a bit. I don't know what this is about me. Nothing to do with university college, really. I just sort of slipped in.
Right. It reminds me of the fact that Sir Ellie and Sir Hirsch were at one point both on the staff at Cambridge. Mm. And I don't think that's ever been the case before in the history of the faculty, that there's been a father and son together as staff members, actually. It's very interesting. Professor Jonowitz, when you came to Trinity, you would have been one of the post-war mature students who had seen a good deal of life before entering college. Do you remember?
I was one of the youngest.
Right.
But we weren't called mature students. I mean, I was 22 when I came up, and I was one of the youngest people around.
Right.
Because many, many people had been in the army and were 6 years in the army, and some of them were much senior to me.
Very interesting. Mr. Lipstein mentioned that he said that when the sort of warriors came back, it was sometimes quite an uncomfortable fit for them because they positions of importance and so forth. Do you remember any of the weekenders that the faculty made use of during this time? Professor Stein was mentioning.
Of whom I was one.
I see.
Because when I had done my degree and done this thesis, I went into pupilage, and while I was a pupil at the bar, I came up here every weekend. Almost. I spent the first year, before I got my fellowship, teaching at University College Oxford.
What were you teaching, Professor Jonowitz?
Contract and tort. The first year, the mods students in Oxford. I personally like to note this because it's a bit of a dig at Oxford. The University College tutor, your tutor, in Marsh, I can't remember the first name. I said to him, offered me this job, coming up on Fridays and teaching. And one of the reasons I was very happy to go there, because I went home. Spent the Friday nights at home.
Yes.
Went back to London before I lived in New York. And I said to Marsh, is it all right if I do it the Cambridge way? Because I don't know anything else. He said, well, what is the Cambridge way? I said, well, I would tell the undergraduates to send me their essays to Chambers by latest Friday afternoon. And I would read them in the train and before I saw them for supervision. I said, oh, that's marvellous. No Oxford dorm would take that trouble. Because the undergraduates at Oxford, they made them read them out in the class.
Good heavens.
Because that worked. I did that for a year. And then I got this, fellowship here, so I decided I wouldn't go on to Oxford, but I would come back to Trinity as a weekend fellow. Not a weekend, but
right.
We're fellows, of course. Don't let it complicate to go. But for that period, I went back and forward from London here every weekend, and then I generally went across to Oxford home. And then went back to London, lived a triangular existence. And I think the weekend was a very good thing, actually. From the undergraduate's point of view, not too many, you needed some people who were concentrating on the academic side. But you could get a great deal of more attention from the class if you said, "Now, this was worrying us in Chambers last Thursday. What do you think about it?"
Yes.
But I'm afraid most people thought this was a poor substitute for proper academics. I don't agree.
Really? Lord Lane was a weekend.
Yes, he is. Well, there are lots of them. Some of my people became Gordon Sloane, for example, Lord Sloane, as he became. That was a weekend under me, as it were.
Good heavens. Very interesting. Yes. Mr. Jolovitz, I wonder if I can ask you to give any anecdotes or reminiscences of colleagues at this time, or colleagues or fellow students, and names that I have here are Sir Derek Bowart, for example. He's 1 year older than you are, so
right.
He would have been perhaps...
Well, I don't know particularly well, but I knew him, of course. But our interests were not very much in common. Not about him, but anecdotal, like about Herschel Oderbein. But along with a lot of other people, I think, including Bobby, we went, of course, to his lectures on international law, which were outstandingly good.
Really?
And lots of us, myself included, decided that we really wanted to be international lawyers. And that wore off quite quickly. Became quite sceptical about international law.
What was the reason for that?
Well, he could be very persuasive, but I always had difficulty with the idea of a law which is dependent on consent. And I don't like states.
Right.
No, I don't think. And I wanted to go to the bar, and I saw a future. It was quite a long time before I decided. I had this dilemma. This is part of this same period. Dilemma. Did I want to go make a career at the bar, or did I want to go back to academic? And Jack Hampson, who was an enormous influence in my life, brought me back here, in fact. I had... was such an extraordinary degree of luck in my life, unmerited. Going back to the coming to Cambridge or Trinity at all, I didn't have any of the problems that young people have today. My father, this is a story, and my father wrote to a man called John Burnaby, who was the senior tutor of Trinity, at the time in charge of admissions. "Dear John," he'd known him when they were both up here before the First World War. "Dear John, my boy will be out of the army shortly. Will you have him at Trinity?" It was over Bertie. "Dear Bertie, delighted, of course."
That's delightful.
That's how I got in. And when I got an assistant lectureship, I didn't apply. Jack fixed it for me when I came back. And I don't regret my decision, though I still sometimes wonder, would I either have been Lord Chief Justice or have starved to death many years ago had I stayed at the bar? I don't know.
It's an interesting thought. Professor Jolovitz, was Professor Stein in any way one of your fellows? I mean, did you see a lot of him?
Not really, no. I think the only way I can really answer this question is that I arguably didn't make a great deal of use of my time in Cambridge. I had three main interests. The law, music, and rowing.
Right.
And nearly all my friends were lawyers or musicians or oarsmen.
Right. Interesting. When you say...
Mostly in Jersey.
When you say music, were you a musician? Did you play an instrument?
Yes, I played the clarinet.
Did you play in a group?
I played the college orchestra.
Lovely. Do you still play, Professor Drogovic?
No, I'm afraid it's all gone. I've got them upstairs, but I haven't touched them for 20 years.
Were there lots of concerts in those days in Cambridge that you could go to?
Oh, yes. Not as many as there are now. I mean, with my own college music society, running more than two concerts in a day.
Lovely.
It's too much.
Yeah. Did you have anything to do with Sir Robbie Jennings?
Only as a man attending his lectures occasionally after the research went off.
Right.
To the Hague.
Right. No, any recollections of his lectures or him as a lecturer?
By comparison with Herschel, I'd have been boring. He wasn't really a patch as a lecturer, because I discovered later that Herschel always appeared to lecture without notes.
Right.
And yet he had it all there. And I discovered later that he spent most of the day in the morning, he lectured at 12, and up until 12, he was going through the lecture as it was going to be.
Dedicated.
Dedicated.
Very interesting. Sir David Williams, was he someone whom you may have encountered?
Oh yes, much younger. I used to have a sort of teasing relationship with David when he first came here from Nottingham. I'm just wondering, it was mainly the... I don't know about a lot of my friends, a number of them, amongst other undergraduates who disappeared. I spent a great deal of time on the river with the boat club.
Delightful.
Much more than I should have done. And that involved being on the committee, running the May Ball and that sort of thing.
Okay.
But I don't think I had any particular friends, apart from Ellie, who I have to say I'd known forever, amongst the law graduates, as they now are, people who graduated after my time. I had a lot of friends who went on to the bar and so on.
Mr. Pritchard, do you have any recollections of him?
Yes. He is younger than me, but he was already on the faculty when I was around. And we got involved heavily in administration and keys.
Yes.
And his wife has been ill, I think, for donkey's years.
Yes. Perhaps Sir William Wade, somebody that...
Well, he taught me, of course.
Oh,
he was the two people who were most responsible for my career, I would say, was Jack Hampson and Bill Wade.
Right.
And Bill became a very good friend. He was a bit younger than Jack, and we used to row together. When I was back again, not as well as Anna Bradley,
right.
We would take a pair or boat out on the river and go up and back.
How lovely. Glanville Williams?
Well, again, I knew him, of course, but only as a member of the faculty, of the staff.
Right.
But after I became a member, we saw quite a lot of him in and out of the faculty. But
yes. Professor Drogovic, that brings me then to actually staff that I know did teach you, and here I have Patrick Duff.
No, he never taught me.
Oh, he didn't teach you, no.
I didn't do Roman law.
He didn't do Roman law, right. Right. Professor Lipstein may have taught you.
Oh, yeah, yes. And it's international law, my first year in international law supervision was here. That's right. That's a limit of his teaching from me, I think. Yes, I think. It was taught by him at Tebbin Wilson.
Perhaps Professor Bailey?
Only his lectures.
Professor Perry, any recollections of him?
very strange. He never taught me that I didn't do any of the things he was teaching. But he was a strange person. You never quite knew where you were with him.
I sort of worked out that he was actually in the Secret Service during the Second World War. He was posted to Ankara for a year.
I never did that.
I thought that was rather odd, you know, when you think of, you know, Turkey's position and so forth. And after a bit of, well, it's just what I think. But I've asked a few scholars. I mean, I asked Sir Eddie, and he laughed and he said, "You'd better ask his son." So I am going to contact his son actually, because he was, by all accounts, a maverick and quite a sort of a bold personality. And I'd like to know more about him.
Yes, indeed. I didn't know that. I had quite a rivalry at one point, and I don't know what he says about either of us. I was quite a long time the representative on the SPTO Council.
That's right.
And the notice went round about the annual meeting about delegates. And he wrote me a flaming letter, and he was serious. That it was outrageous to reflect there was a delegate at a meeting of a society in which he was a member. He wasn't a delegate, he was going in his own right. I was very tiresome about that.
Dear me. I have on my list here as well Harry Holland.
Well, I knew Harry Holland very well, because I wasn't taught by him again. But he was more or less contemporary of my father, a bit senior. But any lawyer from Trinity of that period, and earlier and perhaps a bit later, has a stock of anecdotes. He was a very remarkable man. And it was described by Goodhart, which partly explains it, an absolutely truthful man. By which I mean, not only that he never told a lie, but he always told the truth. And he was a menace in some ways. But that is what I've also, somebody ought to collect these anecdotes before we were all dead. One of the I think most terrifying stories. I've known him for a very long time, because he was a friend of my father's.
Right.
And when we were randomly married in this house, they came to dinner here. And the conversation at the table got around to mad women doing jobs. Now, his wife, I don't really know, was Bursa Gerton, university lecturer in economics and all the rest of it. A heavily occupied lady. And Harry maintained that he could not do a job and be a decent wife. And a bit after it, Marjorie remonstrated. And he had a very distinctive method of speech, made of speech, with very precise accents on the consonants. And few men have tolerated what I have tolerated. You must remember, Marjorie, darling, I am a freak. Now, I've always wanted to know, what does the young host say next? End the story like that. He was an extraordinary man. But he was vice master for ages when I was up.
Did they live in separate homes?
Most of their daughters did, and Sylvia, yes, she lived in Gatton, and he in Trinity.
Right.
And they bought a house in that stone house in Manningley Road, which is now occupied by barristers.
Very beautiful, actually.
Well, they bought that when Marjorie retired. She lived for a bit in Manningley Hall. And they bought that house without ever going inside it. And then it was extremely uncomfortable. They had almost no heating, except what we all called the varicose vein fire. It was one of those very old-fashioned fires with the coils.
Right.
He was a great force in the college. And he wasn't a great scholar. He published practically nothing, but he was an administrator. Mm. And he's really the creator of the faculty as we know it.
Right. That's, I hadn't heard that before. Mm. I knew that he hadn't written.
There's an article in the Cambridge Law Journal, I think, about it.
Right. Do you have any recollections of Emlyn Wade?
Yes, because he was a friend of my father's. And I was pushed around in our class by with his eldest daughter, which is my more or less exact age. But and he was a nice man, a very severe parent. And this sort of thing should go in, but he called me into his room in the old square one day, because he'd known me forever, and said, tell me, I want help. Why is it that when an undergraduate goes to see Herschel Eisbauer, when a couple of minutes he's more or less sitting on Herschel's desk and swinging his legs, and when they come to see me, they stand to attention? And he had no knack of dealing with people on a sort of, he was too much the professor always with the undergraduate.
How interesting.
Whereas Hirsch had a way where he could put you at your ease in no time flat.
I'd always thought that Hirsch Lauterbach was very sort of...
He wasn't Germanic, you'd think that. I mean, you know what a German professor is supposed
Absolutely.
To be like.
Yes.
Interesting. Hirsch wasn't like that at all, I don't think.
Very interesting. Actually, I mean, there's something very deeply relaxed about Sir Eddie as well.
Yeah.
Professor Jonovitz, do you recall Mr. Mickey Dias at all?
Oh, yes.
He's actually the oldest faculty member.
Is he older than Toby Mawson?
I think he is. Mm. I think he is.
Mm. Yes, he was a fellow of the Trinity Hall, and I knew he. He was, of course, senior to me, but I don't think he ever taught me. I knew him somehow, much more when I became a member of the faculty myself. I liked him there from what I've seen. I don't see him much now. You meet him on the street occasionally.
He's actually, of all the eminent scholars, he was the one who's seen the most active service. He was actually in the, involved in bombing submarines.
I didn't know that.
Yes, he was a rear gunner.
Mm-hmm.
And when I asked him about that, I said, my goodness, to think of you, sitting in one of these, doing that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I thoroughly enjoyed my war. Yes. His father was a judge, so was his uncle.
Yes. Yes, he nearly got thrown out by his family for marrying an English girl.
Really?
Well, yes, that was always what I heard as an undergraduate. That he had been more or less excommunicated by the family.
Oh, my goodness.
For the reverse sexist racism.
Right. And then, of course, very sadly, he lost his wife. Yes.
That was quite an awful thing, because he... You know what happened.
I never actually...
Well, this friend who... They went to on holiday to stay with somebody living in, I've forgotten which African country. And Mickey was busy. He got one of his exam papers, Mark, so he took them out with him. And this man, their host... and his friend, was an amateur pilot, and he said, let's go off, we'll go off for the day, I'll fly you all to wherever, and we'll have a lakeside picnic. And David said, Mickey, excuse me, I must get all these scripts. And this friend apparently had never actually passed the medical tests for pilots. And something happened and he crashed the plane into a mountain and they were all killed. And Mickey was left here marking his scripts in the way.
Isn't that incredible? I had no idea. I knew that it was a plane crash, and I assumed it was a commercial flight. That's even more sad, actually. Goodness. Professor Jonovitz, did you practiced as a lawyer for a time? This was before you decided to devote yourself to academia. This was more or less up to the point of your father's early demise. Do you think that his demise had something to do with your decision?
No, I'd come back by then. And it isn't quite right because, although I had the review, but staying at the bar, I was in practice and doing weekend here. Then I decided to come back, but I never completely gave up. I mean, there was a long gap and I didn't do much because I'm cursed with some kind of a conscience, and I thought, you can't maintain a practice if you're not around. You can't say, no, I can't do that case because I'm lecturing on Monday. And you can't just clear off, that's not fair, the undergraduates. But at the end of my active career, really, I was doing a certain amount of advisory work, and I have actually twice addressed the House of Lords, which I quite enjoyed, got involved in things because of the compatible aspect of what I was doing. What I was doing as a youngster was simply mainly industrial accidents.
Right.
People falling off ladders.
Right.
But I did go on, I did get a certain amount of work as a member of the bar. And as I say, I can tell my grandchildren that I have addressed the House of Lords.
I've noticed that, actually. I've been starting to do some research on the main part of your career. The area, of course, that you were working, comparative law, is very important. It's become very, very big in the faculty these days. So I'm looking forward very much, if you're agreeable, in the second interview, discussing how you established yourself as a comparative lawyer.
Oh, yes, I do. Quite a nice little story about that.
Wonderful.